commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And it was a very nice week this week. We had the grand opening for our new Virginia Beach campus.
Did you really?
Yes, on Thursday we were down there, and all the city luminaries were there. The mayor spoke.
Did they give you a key to the city and stuff like that?
We didn't actually get a key to the city. I forgot to ask. That's a very good point, Jim. I should have asked for that, but
the mayor of Virginia Beach, does he wear like the top hat and the sash that says mayor on it? No, that's at McDonald's.
Yeah,
never mind.
No,
sorry.
He gave a very nice talk, and the community has really welcomed us down there. We built a brand new building down there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just beautiful, and the community has just been so welcoming. So we are looking forward to offering the bulk of our programs down in Virginia Beach, and we're very excited about that.
And you have other campuses in that area that are going to open up, right? Hampton Roads area?
Yeah, we've already opened up in Newport News.
Mm-hmm.
So we've opened up our Newport News campus last year. So I've got two campuses down there. And we've just signed the agreement for a building in Alexandria, right on the Beltway, right by Eisenhower Avenue. We're going to open up there March of 2014. So we're just, keep adding locations.
That's
adding
an up-and-coming
locations.
Area.
Yeah, we keep adding campuses as we go along.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really quite exciting every time we open up in a new location. Well, this week we're going to feature the man who was the executive behind the development of the IBM PC. Some years ago, it was an interesting. IBM changed their playbook when they came out with the PC. We'll talk about how he did it, the man behind it, and that, of course, would have been William Cleland Lowe. That's what his mother called him, William Cleland Lowe. And I'm featuring him. He was recommended by one of our loyal listeners last week, and he was also a physicist. So I thought,
physicists get your attention, right?
I think I can get that. The Smithsonian announced that they're releasing 3D images of many of their artifacts, and you can actually print them if you want. You can put them into a 3D printer, and you could just print the artifact if you'd want.
Whoa.
And so they're really hoping that schools will use 3D printers and print these artifacts so the kids can actually touch them in real time, even though they're not there.
How expensive are 3D printers to buy?
The prices are coming down.
Really?
Right? Yeah. I mean, it's more expensive than a regular printer.
Oh, sure. Sure.
But maybe I should review the printers, because the prices, I mean, they used to be like $10,000, now they're $1,000. I mean, the prices are dropping.
So if you want to download, like an Apple in 3D, it'll be a paper object.
It could be plastic. It depends whatever they're squirting out in terms of they're making it. So,
uh-huh.
Like, say for the, SpaceX was making titanium things with a 3D printer. So they would sprinkle out titanium powder, and then they would go over it with a laser to form it into a solid metal.
Wow.
So there are other systems that will squirt out plastics and liquid metals that harden. So there are different types of media. So you could do it with anything. But if you're going to make it in metal, okay, that's more expensive.
Sure. Because
then you've got to use the laser and all of that stuff to build it up. But that's an interesting thing, and you can actually look at them. I'm going to feature that a little bit later in the show and give all the details on that. I've been playing around with navigation systems this week. MapQuest released a new one.
Mm-hmm.
Waze released, I went back to look at Waze.
Did
which
you?
Is because they were recently bought by Google.
Uh-huh.
And it's a social networking
I've used
site.
It.
And I love it because, well, it tells me where the speed traps are. Not that it really matters to me because I only drive. I drive like 45 miles an hour, like a grandmother. And so, grandfather. And
no,
so, you
don't.
Know, and it also tells me where all the speed where all the red light cameras are.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I turned it on this morning coming to the station.
Mm-hmm.
Maryland is loaded with red light cameras.
Yeah.
I'm just on River Road, I passed three of them.
Mm-hmm.
And almost every other light's a red light camera.
Yep.
So, but then when I got to the district, I didn't pick up any red light cameras on the way. Does the district have very many of them?
The district does have them, but on the way that you're coming in, they don't, no.
So I get warnings of that, and I used it coming back all the way from Virginia Beach, and it was fantastic. So that I'll talk a bit about those things.
Be fun.
And then, of course, Adobe had a big security breach. I'll talk about Airbnb. This is the new sharing economy. And, of course, it was a huge, huge mailbag.
Yes,
there's a letter in your mailbox.
Mr. Big Voice, the union said, look, you got to help the doc out because, you know, he's a big deal.
I know.
So, Mr. Big Voice, would you please bring in the mailbag?
Oh, thank you.
Okay.
But that was
a heavy one.
But he only dragged it in. He said he couldn't lift it on the table because he's got a back problem.
And it's always something with this guy.
It's always something. We got an email from Kenneth Bogle.
Mm-hmm.
Hello. Hello. I mean, he's kind of short and to the point.
Why not?
Hello. You mentioned in a previous show the 7 rules of critical thinking that you teach. How can I get a download of this show? Respectfully, Ken. Well, Ken, I'll tell you where you can get the critical thinking model that we use. I mean, we use this in our classrooms. I've been teaching this for years. It, you know, it dates back to Socrates, of course. The model that I like to use was developed by the Foundation for Critical Thinking. criticalthinking.org, and they have a graphical summary of their model. So if you go to the click on the site, it will say critical thinking model. You can click on it. It's a very nice graphic that sort of shows all the elements. But the 8 areas of critical thinking, it's not 7, it's actually 8, is whenever you're trying to think about something, you first of all have to think of the purpose. What's the purpose that we're overall purpose? Like, are we trying to expand? Are we trying to make more money? Are we trying to solve a problem? So you have a broad purpose of all your thinking, and you need to identify that first. Then you narrow down to the specific question at hand within that overall purpose. And then you decide, what information am I going to be required to make a decision? Then you analyze the information using a particular model. And so the model that you use to analyze the data is actually the fourth element. You've got the question at hand, the required information, that's the third one, the model that you use. And using that model in analyzing the data, you come up with the fourth element of critical thinking, which are your conclusions or your inferences. Then once you draw those conclusions, you say, okay, well, if that's true, what are the implications? So the implications would be the fifth one. And then you, of course, you have your underlying assumptions, and you've got your point of view. And so those would be all of the 8 elements of critical thinking. And those are extremely important. We teach those in our class. In fact, I had all my executives read a book. I talked about this, Decisive, How to Make Better Choices in Life and Work by Chip Heath and Dan Heath. And this is the application of critical thinking to decisions in business. This is a fantastic book, and it's not theoretical. They give all kinds of examples because 83% of acquisitions that businesses make fail because they violate the rules of critical thinking. And Dan and Chip Heath go through and really explain that in great, great detail. It was a great question. If you want to go back and get a previous show, you can go to techtalkonline.com. You can search for critical thinking, and then the shows where critical thinking is listed in the outline will pop up, and then you can go directly to those shows.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to get the details, I just go to criticalthinking.org. We got an email from Ken Hutchison. Dear Dr. Schertz, after Microsoft's furnishing updates to Windows XP, won't programs like Norton Internet Security be able to block actions from the Internet, Ken? Well, actually, they will continue to be able to block malicious actions from the Internet. However, chances are, Ken, they're not going to be updated. So new viruses are released. They're not going to be updated, and they won't necessarily be be able to work perfectly on Windows XP. So it's they may be able to, but it's not guaranteed that they'll be able to work for them. And there may be some specific viruses or malicious items that are just specific for XP and not for other things, and then they might not even deal with them. So it's not clear that they're going to support XP, although you could still keep running it and then pick up whatever you could pick up. Now, the people that are going to run XP for legacy systems, though, probably can just run those systems and not hook up to the internet, which is what I'd recommend. Just stay off the internet, run your legacy. You got some legacy business application, just stay off the internet. Now, there is one caveat, though, that I would suggest, and that is don't put a thumb drive in that machine unless it's been scanned by another system. Because thumb drives can, in fact, carry viruses, and so just don't let people come willy-nilly put thumb drives into the machine. Kind of isolate the machine to the extent that you can, and then I think you'll have no problems at all. It turns out that there's a huge installed base of Windows XP. A huge installed base is probably 40% of the installed base. So you might ask yourself the question, well, why wouldn't the antivirus vendors just, you know, if there's such a huge base, why wouldn't they continue to support it? The problem is, Ken, is that installed base is mostly bootlegged. So they're not going to actually pay for anything.
Mm-hmm.
But if the antivirus companies would like to donate it and it could be pirated, then they would certainly use it. So I don't think there's going to be a big commercial interest in doing that. So my recommendation is, you got a legacy system, it's not a problem, just stay away from the internet. We got an email from Mary Wilson. Doc Schertz, I'd be grateful if you'd talk about the features and costs of Amazon Workplaces, which promises to provide Windows 7 desktops on demand to almost any client platform. Which would be the Mac OS X, iOS, Android, and Windows. Thanks, Mary. Mary's one of our long-term listeners. Well, Amazon is offering desktops. It's basically in a thin client mode, and in their lowest tier desktops are available for $35 per user per month. So you're going to spend $400 a year to get this desktop. For a 1,000-user setup, Amazon claims that you'll have a 59% cost savings over delivering the same desktops on premises. And they're touting this as being cost savings because you're going to save on support as well as on basic software. Now, the desktops are provided by way of a client app. It's an application that runs. It's a thin client application that runs on your computer, and that client app runs on most platforms. And as Mary said, Mac OS X, iOS, Android, and Windows. Now, four different virtual machine configurations are available. You can get a single virtual CPU with 3.75 gigabytes of memory and 50 gigabytes of persistent storage, which means that's the equivalent of your hard drive storage. Or you can go all the way up to a dual CPU with 7.5 gigabytes of memory and up to 100 gigabytes of persistent storage, or the equivalent of hard disk space. Organizations with an existing Active Directory repository or other in-network resources can connect to those desktops securely using a VPN. So you can link back to your servers using a VPN without a problem. Now, software is included with these systems. You get all the free stuff, of course, like Adobe Reader, Adobe Flash, Firefox, and zip files. But you can get higher-end bundles that include Microsoft Office Professional 2013 or Entrend Micro's antivirus. And they'll customize your bundles for you if you want specific software. You can also transfer existing Windows software licenses to workspaces, and they'll charge you a small fee for that. You won't pay for the licensing, but you'll have to pay for the storage and the processing capacity. Now, Amazon's cloud is typically competed with other services like Google, Rackspace, IBM, and so on. But it also, this particular application puts them in direct competition with the virtual desktop providers like Citrix and VMware. These are the two big names. And Microsoft also has some VDI presence, virtual desktop presence. But this particular product is not really competitive with these particular vendors yet. But as we've seen with Amazon, they continue to evolve it. And so maybe in the future, they might go for it. And so I think this is a product to watch, and we'll see whether they can outcompete Citrix and VMware in this virtual desktop infrastructure.
Okay, so this is not an actual. This isn't a box. This is like an app, right?
You're basically running the application is running on the Amazon servers, and they just send you whatever's going to be displayed on the screen. So you have basically a virtual machine inside of the Amazon servers. And you talk to your virtual machine. It's your machine. You own that little space. And then whenever you want to display something from your machine, it sends it back to your display.
So the selling feature here is this is portable. You can go to whatever hard desktop you want to and bring this up, right?
You could go anywhere. You could go to any desktop you'd want. And you also don't have to have a powerful computer. You could you could have really a slow computer because all you're doing it is a display. So this is a
so this makes it would make a slow computer faster.
Yeah, so this is called Thin Client. I mean, in the old days, they called them dumb terminals because all the processing was done centrally, and the terminal would just display. And so there is a trend for more and more thin client activities as the internet gets faster and faster and more reliable. And so Amazon is moving into this.
Do you like this?
Yeah, I think it's fine. I mean, I don't know that I would go necessarily with Amazon. I mean, you got to look at the security deal. I mean, you've got to look at their security infrastructure.
Is it like buying a new car the first year it comes out?
Yeah, I would probably not do it the first year. Amazon has been more of a consumer kind of product, so I think we'd wait to see how the security shakes out. But Amazon has been a real mover in this marketplace as they market their cloud services, and they've been scaling and dropping prices. So I think long term, they're going to be a real significant player here, and VMware and Citrix are going to have to watch out. We got an email from Aisha in Virginia Beach. Dear Tech Talk, someone received an email apparently from my Gmail address.
Uh-oh.
But I never sent that email. And now I received a letter from their attorney accusing me of harassing his client.
Oh, boy.
Now, the email in question was sent last April. What can I do to clarify the situation? Thanks, Aisha. Well, most email that we send are accurate. You know, most emails you get are really from the person you think. But it's easy for someone to pretend like it came from someone else. You see, when the email protocol was set up, it was set up in the trusted model that you would only be talking to people who you trusted and you knew so they didn't feel the need that you'd have to actually secure the from data on where it was sent from. They just trusted that people put in the correct data. But actually, you can put anything you want in the from field. And in fact, this is what spammers do. Whenever they send out spam, they always make it from somebody else. They never make it from themselves. And so the from line is actually a very unreliable indicator of who actually sent the email. Now, there are headers on the email that are in addition to the from line. And because as an email is sent, it goes through a various number of servers that have IP addresses. And there's kind of a track on where it came from, the IP address, and where it's going. And so there is additional information in the header that you can look at. And so the header may be able to provide information that it really wasn't yours. Now, the problem is you actually have to have the email that they have. And if they forward you the email, you're only going to see the return address. All that header information that they have in the original email is not going to be sent to you. So they're going to actually have to print out the header information, and they'll have to do it. And so they could either, when you go to the email, typically, and depending on what email client you've got, you could either say view source or view headers, or if you've got Gmail, it's like view original. And then you'll see all the header information. And so it may be possible that they could go in and you could track the IP address train that's in that header information to prove that it didn't come from you.
Mm-hmm.
But be mindful that if it's really a smart person, they could also change that. So, it's worth investigating, but this is not an uncommon problem. And I think it would be difficult for them to prove this in court because of this uncertainty as to where it really came
difficult
from.
Difficult in proving that she actually sent it.
Yeah, it would be very difficult. That I mean, it would be very difficult. I don't think they could really take legal action against you. But if you want to talk to them and try to pin down where it came from, you could do this, look at this header thing and try to figure it
now,
out.
Now, she's got Gmail. On the Gmail server, there would be – you could go to her outbox on Gmail through Google, right? And,
so you could,
and prove that it didn't come out of her box, right? Or that there was no email from her?
Well, I mean, assuming that, you know, I mean, it's hard to prove an absence
mm-hmm.
because she could have just deleted it.
That's true. You could do that.
You know.
But there's no record of that on the Google server because, I mean, I'm hearing all this stuff like in the this bullying case with these two football players where they've brought up all of these texts that these guys have sent back and forth. Is there no sort of permanent record somewhere that this thing does or doesn't exist?
So the thing is, if you completely delete it from Gmail – now, so the question is Google going to store all that information just in the event that somebody wants it? I think they probably won't.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you may be able to go back to some intermediate backup data before it was deleted, and there may be something there, but you couldn't really count on it. And I don't think Google's going to even go
bother
for
with it.
You're not getting anything from Google. I mean, I just don't think you're going to be able to do anything with that. I think this view source and view header is probably the best thing, and it is interesting to look at. You can just go to view header or view original in your Gmail. It's interesting to look at all the header information. There's a huge amount of data there that's, and you can kind of figure things out.
So she while this is going to be a nuisance, Aisha shouldn't be worried about this.
Think you should. You have to be worried about it. And you can email them and ask them to do view. You know, ask them to print out the header and send it to you, and then you could do further research on the header information to help them pin it down. But I think the fact that you would be asking for this and trying to sell it, they'll say, you know, this is probably not the person who's going through all this work.
Yeah.
So we got an email from Alan in Fairfax, Virginia. Dear Tech Talk, some forums are not allowing me to register because they claim I'm a spammer. The administrator in one of them emailed me that my IP address is on a blacklist. Now, I've checked the IP address on many blacklists, and my IP address is always green. So what's the matter? What should I do? Should I change my IP address in any way I can locate that blacklist and get taken off? Love the show, Alan. Well, IP address blacklists are normally unreliable because an IP address is not necessarily a good way to block spammers. And it's a poor approach to controlling spam. I mean, but some administrators use it. And I did a check for these blacklists, and I searched them. They're just boatloads of forum blacklists. Now, what we do on all of the forms that we fill out, we use CAPTCHAs, where it's this funny little graphic that comes out that's hard to be read by a computer, and you have to type in whatever this distorted graphic says. And that CAPTCHA was designed kind of to get rid of these machine spamming, so to speak. But when I checked these blacklists, what was interesting, I could go to some of these blacklists and I could just add IP address. I could say, well, this is a spammer, and you just add it on. So it's kind of easy to add things to these blacklists, but it's hard to get them off. So, I mean, so you have a few options. If you could have them tell you what blacklist they're using, and there are a lot of them, so... Then you could go to that blacklist and you could appeal it. You could, you know. Now, the problem is, as I understand it, most of these blacklists are not very managed very well. They don't have many people there, so you may not even be able to get a response from them, but you could certainly try that. Now, you could try to use a different IP address. I mean, you could just go down to the local internet cafe. That'd be a different IP address. You could go to your internet service provider and ask for a different IP address, but chances are that they've blocked a whole range of IP addresses from your particular ISP. So even if you change to another one, it may not work, but you could try that. The last thing you do, you could use a proxy service where you go out, you log on, and then you're essentially using the IP address of the proxy server. And you could get a free one like the Onion Router, TOR, that was developed by the U.S. government to help people in countries that have censorship get around the censorship. Or you could use a VPN service like Hotspot Shield. Now, most of these are made so you can have anonymity when you're on the net, but for this purpose, it does give you another another IP address, but they're just a little slower. So those are kind of your options. But if I would communicate with the person at the forum and let them know that this is a false positive, and I would maybe work with them to have a better way of screening for spammers. Those
Excellent.
Are very good questions. Listen, we love the emails. So email us at techtalk@stratford.edu, and we will get it on the show, or else we'll answer you directly. And, of course, you can always check out all of our MP3s and our podcasts. We're going to techtalkonline.com, or you can go to Apple iTunes and get the podcast directly there, too.
And as it is Saturday morning, the classroom of the airwaves is open. This is Tech Talk Radio on 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, Federal News Radio. We'll be right back with more after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Technology is constantly changing. An effective IT manager must not only understand the possibilities and limitations of the technology, but also the requirements and constraints of the business world. Enhance your career today with a master's degree from Stratford University School of Computer Information Systems. Classes are offered day, evening, and weekends to match your busy schedule and are taught by experienced faculty members with industry experience. Earn your master's degree in as little as 15 months with an accelerated program in software engineering, information systems, information assurance, or telecommunications. Learn more about earning your master's degree from Stratford University at stratford.edu or call 1-800-444-0804. Disclose statements available at stratford.edu/disclosures. Stratford University, 1-800-444-0804.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're going to feature William Cleland Lowe. William, he's also...
That's what his mom called him,
that's
right?
That's what his mom called him, yeah. His friends called him Bill.
Bill, or Clee.
Clee, but his, loose acquaintances called him William CeeLo. And he was the IBM executive who led the team that developed the IBM PC. William Cleland Lowe was born January 15th, 1941, in Easton, Illinois. He attended Lafayette College on a basketball scholarship,
mm-hmm.
but he gave up that athletic scholarship to devote more time to his studies. In 1962, he received a Bachelor of Science in Physics from Lafayette College, which is located in Pennsylvania. Well, you see, he's a physicist, so of course he had to devote more time to his studies. It was probably very intense.
You are one, so you know,
yes.
Right?
After graduation, he joined IBM as a product test engineer. Now, IBM became interested in the personal computer market in the late 1970s, well after brands such as Apple and Commodore and Atari had established a beachhead. Now, Lowe believed that IBM should develop a PC that could be mass marketed. He wanted to expand the company's reach beyond businesses and reach directly into people's homes. Now, Lowe was director of IBM's Boca Raton Labs in 1980, when Atari proposed to make microcomputers, which IBM would sell.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I didn't realize that. They were trying to get IBM to market their computer. So Lowe took this Atari proposal, along with an alternative suggestion that IBM just acquire Atari outright. He took it to the IBM Management Committee. and they reportedly pronounced his suggestion as the dumbest thing they'd ever heard of. that's tech speak in IBM, and this is in quotation marks.
This is sort of in the Steve Jobs vernacular, right?
That's right.
This does suck.
The dumbest thing we've ever heard of. That was their response. But he did convince his bosses that, okay, forget about this whole Atari deal. He convinced his bosses that they should assemble and build a PC themselves. So IBM CEO Frank Carey then tasked William Cleland Lowe to put together the design and bring to market an IBM product within 1 year. Which for IBM is just unbelievable because they have this, you know, they got this big, you know, when they work on a new computer, it's a big project, multi-year project. Mm-hmm. There's a one-year turnaround. So the code name was Project Chess. And Lowell recruited a group of 12 engineers who became known as the Dirty Dozen. And they would design and build the personal computer, which they dubbed Acorn. I mean, everything there at IBM is very secret. Okay, they got the Project Chess, which is developing Acorn with the Dirty Dozen designers. And they actually, the Dirty Dozen, they came together and they put together the computer within 1 month.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that team was led by Don Estridge, and I've featured Don Estridge before on Profiles in IT. So they put together the prototype for this IBM PC in 1 month. Now, how were they able to do that? They were able to do it because they just took components that other people built and strapped them together. And they knitted them together using, you know, a computer. All the pieces talk to each other using a bus, which is sort of a parallel communication channel between components. So the chip and the peripheral boards, everything talked to each other through this communication channel called the bus. And they wanted an open architecture, so they built an IBM based on open architecture, and the bus architecture was open, so anybody could do it. All the standards were open architecture, and because they had an open architecture, anybody could build a card for the PC because the bus was a standardized bus, and so people could they could actually have vendors building things on their own, and so that allowed them to have a very low price point because they had so many people working on it. And this was for IBM, this was like a major breakthrough because IBM had never let outsiders develop anything. I mean, IBM made all their own chips. I mean, they didn't even use an IBM chip. They used a chip made by some upstart company called Intel mm-hmm. out in California. They didn't even write their own software for the operating system. They went to some little upstart in Seattle called Microsoft. And so, and at that point, it was really an upstart, for it was very small. So in 1981, the company began selling the IBM 5150 personal computer at a retail price of $1,565, and that did not include the monitor. And it was bundled with a handful of applications like BASIC and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
The 5150 was powered by a 4.77 megahertz Intel 8088 microprocessor. It came with a whopping 16 kilobytes of RAM that you could expand to 256 kilobytes of RAM. It used the advanced operating system called MS-DOS 1.0, which was made by then a little-known company in Washington State named Microsoft.
Wow. Amazing.
On January 3rd, 1983, this was about, you know, this was about a couple of years after it was first announced, about a year and a half after it was first announced, IBM declared, or rather Time Magazine declared, the IBM PC the machine of the year. See, because Time Magazine, every January, they have this thing called the Man of the Year.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the man of the men just weren't even acknowledged that year, and they devoted to the machine of the year, and it was the IBM PC. Now, the commitment to open architecture and off-the-shelf parts had other consequences for IBM that were really unanticipated, and these were called IBM compatible machines or clones. So because of open architecture, because anybody can make the components, well, shoot, anybody can slap them together. So what happened? We had Compaq Computer start up and Dell Computer start up selling IBM-compatible PCs or clones, and they just took off. Now, IBM then went back. They said, you know, this open architecture and all this open operating system, we got to do something about that. We got to rein this thing in because we don't like all these clones. So then they came up with this idea of a proprietary bus, which called the microchannel bus. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember the microchannel. And this was their proprietary bus that only they could make components for. And then they didn't like this this open operating system. So then they started working on OS2, Operating System 2. And they were working on that because they wanted to, like, rein in the software, rein in everything. And during this time when they were trying to pull the IBM to make it more proprietary, William Cleland Lowe was heavily, heavily criticized. People just did not like this thing. And, in fact, the marketplace just rejected it. Once IBM went to this microchannel, played an OS2, their sales tanked. Eventually they just got out of the PC market because they couldn't even sustain it. Now William Lowe, after this, but this was actually a transformational product for computers because it really did get low cost computers in business. And see, up to that point, that sort of the primary personal computer was the Apple, which is sort of this uppity thing that would be in the home for the artist. It wasn't viewed, I mean, with the name Apple. I mean, a bank is not going to get an Apple machine because it just doesn't sound businesslike. But IBM, no problem. And so IBM really did bring into the marketplace the acceptance of personal computers in business because of their brand. And they didn't, and they ended up, I think, probably not making as much money out of it as they would have liked, but they did. They definitely changed the course of history here. Now, William Cleland Lowe went on to serve as IBM VP and president of the Entry Systems Division, which oversaw the development and manufacture of IBM PCs and other businesses. In 1988, Lowe left IBM for Xerox, probably at the height of all this criticism over OS2 and microchannel bus. And he stayed there for 3 years, and then he went in 1991 to become CEO of Gulfstream Aerospace.
Wow.
And they make business jets.
Right.
That was quite a leap. Now, this is something that's quite interesting. Despite his accomplishments, William Cleland Lowe did not learn how to use the PC until he left IBM and began working for Xerox.
How is this even possible?
Well, you know, back then, I mean, executives were proud of the fact, well, I don't even know how to turn on the PC. I have people who do that. you need a letter? I have people who can make a letter for me. I don't do that. So there was kind of the great divide. Now, mm-hmm. I think the great divide is gone. Now, I think all CEOs probably type their own letters now. Now, the reason I'm featuring him is that this year, in fact, just a month ago, he died of a heart attack in 2013 mm-hmm. at age 82 after living a long and productive life. There you go. William Cleland Lowe, the executive behind IBM's foray into the PC business.
Why? We hope you were paying attention, because coming up in just a moment is your chance to win a free prize from the doctor himself by showing us your knowledge in the pop quiz on Tech Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2, and online at federalnewsradio.com and techtalkonline.com.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
A budget analyst, a vice president of sales. These are today's business leaders, and a degree from Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers you a powerful path to navigate the corporate world. The School of Business Administration at Stratford University offers both bachelor's and master's degree programs for a real-world education. In fact, many of today's Stratford business grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. It's time. Time to put your talents out there on your terms and set your own pay. If you are ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Master's in Entrepreneurial Management covers the skills to launch your business from writing a solid business plan to financing, branding, and marketing. Choose from our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge. Contact us today at stratford.edu. Stratford University, it's time to be more.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now it's time for Washington's most popular and longest running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Welcome back to the classroom of the airways.
I'm not going to even...
Also known as Tech Talk Radio.
Right.
Now, whenever there is a classroom, there must be an assessment. So we're going to give an assessment here, which we call a pop quiz. If you get the right answer to the pop quiz, you'll win two tickets to fine dining, the Escoffier Dining Room, plus you will get an A-plus for today's show.
Which will, that'll get you way far in life,
that
too.
That really will. You can just take that to the bank. earlier in the show, we talked about William Cleland Lowe. He, of course, was in charge of IBM's Boca Raton Labs in the 1980s. And Atari brought this proposal to IBM that they wanted IBM to actually produce and distribute. They wanted IBM to distribute the Atari computer, or else, they wanted IBM to be the distribution channel. So William Cleland Lowe went to the highest levels in IBM and he said, "Look, let's either sell the Atari computer or let's acquire Atari." He said, "This is a great way for us to get into the computer business." What exactly did that management committee tell him? And they just, they didn't mince any words. But what exactly did the management committee tell him when he made that proposal regarding Atari?
Well, if you have the answer to that question, you need to call us lickety-split. If you're calling from east of Easton, Illinois, it's 877-936-9333. Lafayette College, by the way, is located in Easton, Pennsylvania. So if you're calling from west of Easton, Pennsylvania,
yes,
it's 877-936-9333. Of course, everybody else can reach us on the wild card line, which is 877-936-9333. Or
if you're calling from Siberia, you could use Skype and connect to simply Tech Talk Radio 1, and that call will be forwarded to the studio free of charge.
But I'd say 877-936-9333. That's just me.
Yes.
Not to up the dock.
But from Siberia, you need the country code
right.
+1. You have to put +1 in front of that.
Right.
Then. Okay, the 3D models have now been released of Smithsonian artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
With the Smithsonian X 3D Explorer, anyone with an internet connection can examine and manipulate and print exact 3D models of a few of the Smithsonian's most precious items. The 3D scanning was made, for instance, of the cosmic Buddha's faded markings. You could even see the cosmic Buddha's faded, and they sharpened them up so you could read them. Have you ever looked at the Smithsonian's cosmic Buddha before?
I have not, but I think I will very
shortly. I was looking at the cosmic Buddha this morning over the internet. Autodesk uses a 3D LiDAR. LiDAR is a short for laser radar. Use a 3D LiDAR in order to create hyper-accurate models of the artifact. Now, the technology works by running a laser scan over the object and capturing even the most minute details using the back reflection. And that results in replicas that are even more accurate than the original. Matthews, they said the cosmic Buddha dates to around 300 AD. Now, Autodesk revealed the Smithsonian X3D Explorer to the public at the Smithsonian Castle this month. Now, the tool was released with models of about 20 artifacts, all handpicked as the best of the best by the curators of the Smithsonian's 19 museums. Now, they hope to work with Autodesk to model many more of its 137 million artifacts.
Wow.
A collection so large that the museum has yet to photographically archive each. What's more, each 3D model will be open source, so that students and researchers with 3D printers are welcome to print their own copies for further studies. I mean, just think about this. You've got a classroom of kids learning about Native American tribes. So the teacher could 3D print copies of the Smithsonian collection of pottery, and the kids could actually hold it and see what it felt like. Now, the curator selected hot spots in each of the items, so you could click on that hot spot, and you could see what makes the artifact special or what's special about that hot spot. See, if you're at the museum, you're standing in front of an object, you can see the front, but you can't see the back.
No.
So, like, for instance, they've got Wright Brothers airplane. So you can actually turn it around, look at the back, and you can see how the bicycle chain on the back is set up, and you can't even see that when you're seeing it at the museum. Now, you've got to use either Chrome or Firefox. I went onto the site with Microsoft Explorer, and they said, well, it's not compatible. But they said a release which is soon to be out would be compatible. So simply, you can simply go to just Google 3D models Smithsonian, and it'll take you directly to the webpage, and you can just look at all these things. You can flip them around. It actually is quite nice. I was playing with that all morning this morning.
I just looked at Cosmic Buddha. It is indeed cosmic would be the right word to describe it. Now, we don't have a winner yet. So, Doc, why don't you ask the question one more time? I think we've stumped folks.
Earlier in the show, we were talking about William Cleland Lowe, and he, of course, took the idea that they could acquire Atari or they could market Atari's computer. He took that to the management committee, and they came back, and they responded to him with this, you know, short but very strong message. What did they tell him?
Hint is they didn't like it a whole lot.
When they rejected it, yes.
So once again, the number to call is 877-936-9333, 877-936-9333. Doc, I think we may be getting a winner. Why don't you go ahead and talk about something else?
So MapQuest has come out with a new app. They try to remain relevant. MapQuest used to be one of the main navigation maps out there until Google Maps came along and Apple Maps came along. But They recently released a new app for the Android and the iPhone after building it from scratch. This was a 9-month endeavor, and the interface is actually quite nice. They've got layers of it, so you can actually click on things to show coffee houses, bars, gas stations, parking. It's very nice. You can create custom categories. And you get traffic updates. It builds traffic updates into the thing. I don't know if it does it as well as Waze. So I've downloaded it. I've been playing around with it this morning. The one thing I don't like about it is you get ads.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't
mm-hmm.
like this. The ads is at the top. It bothered me. So I paid $3.99 to get rid of the ads. So I'm going to be comparing over the next weeks this MapQuest application against Waze, against Google Maps, to see which one I like the best.
Very good. We do have a winner on the line. Well, I won't pronounce him a winner yet. We have to go through the formality of the situation here. Let's go to line number two. This is Richard calling from Adelphi. Richard, good morning.
Good morning.
All right, Doc, go ahead and ask the question.
Earlier in the show, I talked about William Cleland Lowe. He went to the IBM upper management and proposed either that they acquire Atari or they distribute the Atari computer. And what did the management committee tell him?
This is the dumbest idea we've ever heard.
That is correct. That is correct. You win two tickets to fine dining to the Escoffier Dining Room. Just or the Karim Dining Room. Just stay on the line, and we'll get the tickets out to you next week. Give your name and address to our trusty professor.
This would be our adjunct professor for prize distribution and crowd management, Andrew Mitchell.
Great.
I keep adding to the... Stand by. Andrew will be right with you, and we will be back in just a moment. You are indeed listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, and 107.7 FM HD2 online. FederalNewsRadio.com, TechTalkOnline.com. Be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. A rewarding future as a holistic caregiver or nurse practitioner. Combining the art of caring with the human science makes nursing today's breakout field. Stratford University's School of Nursing at the Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers a patient-centered approach with valuable core clinical training. Stratford provides a real-world education in nursing. In fact, many of today's Stratford nursing grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And I've been playing with Waze this last week, too. And it's actually a product which is a navigation system combined with social networking. And so when anybody logs on and starts using Wave, Waze actually tracks your movement. And so if you stop moving, it can tell there's a backup. Mm-hmm. And then I get a notice. I was in a backup coming back from Virginia Beach, unfortunately. And I stopped dead in my tracks. And Waze said, are you in traffic or did you just pull off to park? And I said, no, I'm in traffic. And so then another thing came up. They said, is it a standstill? So I clicked on it. It was a standstill. So everybody, and I could see the Waze people in front of me, because anybody who's logged into the Waze is using Waze, their little icon shows up. So I could see all the people in front of me who were on Waze, and then the whole road was red until you go up to the very front. And then finally, right, when there were no Waze listeners on there, I could see exactly where it ended.
Right.
I could see exactly where it ended. And so Google recently paid more than $1 billion for them, and this was extremely useful. You can get it either for iPhone or for Android. And so you get live routing based on community-generated traffic and road info. So like when I was driving home, it would say there's going to be a disabled vehicle on the right. And every time it was there. I'd just pick it up, and then as I would pass it, it would ask me, is it still there? And you could hit thumbs up that it's still there, or you could say not there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that you're constantly updating it. And whenever there was a speed trap, anybody in front of me would say there's a hidden speed trap on the left. It would say, beware, there's a hidden speed trap coming up. Which, not that it mattered to me, because I only drive 45 miles an hour,
no,
Jim. But
I
was gathering data for the show.
Usually in the left lane with the left turn signal on.
That's right. I was gathering data for the show. And so you can, with Waze, you can actively report accidents, hazard, police, and other events. And so I used it all the way back from Virginia Beach, and it was actually incredibly accurate. I was actually amazed that, and I could see exactly where the traffic,
where it breaks free, right?
Where it actually ended, when it would start up, and it was actually quite good. And this is better traffic information, I think, than I was getting from either Google Maps or from MapQuest. And I think that's why Google bought them, because now they're starting to integrate the Waze social network into their Google Maps, which will make it really incredible.
And before they started doing that, of all the stuff I'd ever looked at, Google Maps was the best, because Google Maps, I mean, there's a latency issue. I mean, it's like maybe a 5 minute or so delay between when it happens and you start to see it on the maps. But I tell you, when I look at a traffic camera and the line is red on the screen, there's brake lights. And it's the most accurate thing I've ever used.
So now the thing is, this Waze, it automatically reroutes you whenever there are traffic conditions that show up. It's got complete voice-guided navigation. Now, what I like about it, you can actually send a web link to somebody, and they can track you as you drive.
Mm-hmm.
So you can actually send you can hit, there's a mail option, and you mail the link to the person. Suppose you're driving across country. You mail the link to them, and they can go to that link, and it says your estimated arrival time, and it shows exactly where you are on the path. So they can watch you as you're driving. That was kind of a neat thing.
That's pretty neat.
Now, it's also integrated into Facebook. So I don't know. I don't think I would want to do this, but no. you can actually see all your Facebook friends and where they are, and you can meet up easily. Now, every time I would pass like a disabled vehicle, I would click the button, say disabled vehicle, or I'd see a speed trap. I would put in the speed trap because. Not that I was really trying to tell anybody anything, but I was just testing ways.
He's been pulled over recently.
I was just trying to test ways out. And if you report a speed trap, you get 6 points. So if
what do the points do for you? That I don't get.
You get little badges.
You get like
a Waze superstar.
All right, whatever.
And then you can.
It's kind of like winning the pop quiz, except without food.
And then you can also you have like a little icon that's and so I can look at all the other Waze people on the map, and you can pick an icon. So you can either be like a speed demon, or you can be sad, or you can be unhappy. And so you can look at all these little icons, and you can see all these happy, smiling faces. Somebody sad's going by you, so you can see somebody's angry going by you. So it's sort of a combination of a navigation system and a social network.
Are you trying to put us broadcast-based traffic reporters out of business? Is that what you're trying to do?
No, but it's unbelievably good. I could not get better information. I knew exactly how long this backup was. I knew exactly where it ended. And it was happening in real time because I had Waze people right in front of me.
Here's the problem. In most places now, you're not able to mess around with your device while you're driving so that you really shouldn't be using something like that while you're in the car, right?
No, you're really not... You're really not allowed to be using it, but so I would actually pull over
Jim, you've got an answer for everything.
So what I would do is I'd say I better update Waze. So I would pull over and update Waze, and then I would pull back into the traffic.
Now it takes you 3 hours to drive 3 miles to work.
It's a major deal.
No, it doesn't.
But now. This morning, I did notice one red light camera in Maryland that was not noticed by Waze. I got 6 points.
I was going to say, what kind of a badge did you get for that?
I got 6 points for that one. Oh, now, here's the one problem. When you're running Waze, the GPS is running continuously, and it keeps reporting your information. It just drains your battery. So you'd better get it. You've got to plug it into the charger. And my phone was running hot. So my phone was actually quite hot because.
So now I'm going to have a rash of car fires to report because people's phones are melting into their seats.
So my phone was really, it's the hottest I've ever seen it because it was like, it was.
Was it glowing red?
The whole way back, I was sending Waze information, but it was quite nice.
Folks, just listen to me on the radio. I'll tell you where the problem is.
Okay. Yeah, that's very good.
We're going to keep it here, Doc, because we're plumb almost out of time.
Well, you probably want to know about Project Loon, didn't you?
I was all week I've been waiting to hear about
Project
this.
Loon. Well, I knew you'd want to know about that. Well, these are balloons. Google has a project that they're going to provide internet to the world with internet balloons. Balloons that provide internet access for, remote areas. Now, they've got balloons that they stay aloft for 100 days, and they'll circumnavigate the Earth 3 times before they're being replaced.
Mm-hmm.
So they plan to have balloons circulating around the whole Earth. Now, this floating network in the sky called Project Loon, the balloons are just going to follow the wind network. So they'll adjust their height in order to navigate and go different directions. And then when they replace the balloon, they'll keep the same electronics and launch it again. And so the idea is that they're going to basically provide internet access to remote areas of Africa because, they sell ads. So
well,
this Project Loon is a long-term project to get the worldwide internet going. I tell you, the show just ends so quickly.
Yes.
But we love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu, and we just love it when you check out the Stratford website and check out those programs. Go to stratford.edu, check out the programs, and let them know you heard about them on Tech Talk.
And we will return with another show next Saturday at 9 here on Federal News Radio. Thanks for listening.
commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT-FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Coming up today on Federal News Radio, we've got Navy football taking on the University of South Alabama. It is the final home game for the Navy midshipmen, 3:30 p.m. for the kickoff, 2 o'clock for the coaches' game, and all the pregame coverage here on Federal News Radio. It is going to be cloudy around the area today, maybe some drizzle, some fog lingering right now. Outside of studios in Northwest, it is currently 50 degrees, 10 o'clock at Federal News Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility.